From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on a Virginia dairy farm in early 2011. Ricky Rash found the body of his 15-year-old son, Eric, who had killed himself. The police recommended that the Rash family take a look at Eric's online accounts for clues, his email, his phone, especially his Facebook account, to see if there were, perhaps, bits of information that would provide an explanation for his suicide. But his parents were told they would not be allowed to access all of those things. Their case is one of thousands that happen on an annual basis, and so far, the law is murky regarding who can access our online accounts after death. The truth is, for now, no one really is all that clear on who can and can't, for example, close a Facebook account, close a Twitter account for a deceased person, examine the direct or private messages. But there's a movement to at least start changing the law and kind of codify these things. Now, Yahoo says the proposed change would violate our privacy. This hour, we examine the proposal and the current landscape. We welcome Scott Maloof, an attorney who helps other attorneys use social media, text, and web-based evidence. And you can learn more about Scott at the website scottmaloof.com. It's M-A-L-O-U-F. He's also on Twitter at Scott Maloof. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Evan.
And Mike Johansson's back with us this hour. He lectures on social media and digital communications at the New School of Communication at RIT, and he offers social media solutions through an endeavor called Fixitology Online. Mike Johansson, nice to see you.
Great to be back.
Scott, let me start with you, because you recently wrote a piece about these proposed legal changes, and my understanding is one proposed law. Are there multiple laws? There's one main one that states are considering. Is that right?
The framework is this. There are about, I think, 8 or 9 states that have laws governing some aspect of online account access after death or after some kind of incapacity. But the main one that I've written about that is taking a lot of state legislators' interest is called UFADA. And that ungainly name stands for Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. And what that is it's a uniform law, as the name states, proposed by the Uniform Law Commission, which is a private group that provides various laws to have all 50 states, as well as the District of Columbia, adopt them. So each state would look at this uniform law and say, how might this fit with what we do as a state? And the goal is to have the same law in every state to make it easier for consumers as well as online service companies.
I want to listen to CBS News did a report on the Rash family, and I want to listen to what Ricky Rash said again. He's the man who had that terribly sad story of finding the body of his 15-year-old son, Eric, who had killed himself on their dairy farm. And Ricky Rash described for CBS News the confusion that he and his family members had after police told them, hey, you got to get into his Facebook account. You've got to check out what might have been going on. Let's listen to what Ricky said.
We couldn't access his accounts as adults, and he being a minor. Parents have been very surprised that they were not allowed access or they can be denied access.
Scott, so how new is, again, you call it UFADA, how new is this legislation? How long have we been hearing about potential legal issues surrounding this?
The legislation itself, the Uniform Law Commission just finalized it back in early October. And the state of Delaware has enacted its version of UFADA, which I believe is very similar to the Model Act, and that recently just happened. And as to hearing about this, this has been going on for a few years. I'd say some cases regarding online access are back to maybe 2011 and 10. Obviously, as users adopted it and then passed away, that's when these issues came up.
I'm looking at what Yahoo said, and Yahoo has been very tough on this. Yahoo's senior legal director of public policy, Bill Ashworth, wrote, quote, when an individual signs up for a Yahoo account, they agree to our terms of service, which outlines that neither their account nor the contents of their private communications are transferable at the time of death. When you go down the list, Facebook, Yahoo, Google, Twitter, they all sort of have slightly different things. And Mike Johansson, who's been following social media for a long time, we've talked about privacy with you on this program before, but privacy at the time of death is, you know, it is not a trite issue. For a lot of people, it's a very serious thing, and they all seem to have slightly different takes, don't they?
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me is, and again, I'm not a lawyer, Scott's the lawyer, but the whole issue of presumably you're not a person once you're dead, So if you're not a non-person, can you still have privacy? And I guess the law at the moment would say you do. But it's just interesting to me. A stat I'd came across a few days ago when looking into this was at the current rate of growth on Facebook, in about 25 years, there'll be more dead people on Facebook than living people.
Yeah, and I mean, it's an amazing thing to think about. But let's look here. Twitter writes this about their policy, quote, "Please note, we are unable to provide account access to anyone regardless of his or her relationship to the deceased." Twitter says, "We're really sorry, but you are not getting access if you don't, essentially, if you don't have a password." Google has recently established a new feature called Inactive Account Manager, which prompts users to decide the fate of their own accounts if they die. If the account user does not make a selection on it, Google's policies are pretty strict, warning survivors that obtaining access to a deceased person's email account will, quote, be possible only in rare cases. Yahoo's made it clear they don't want to have to be pushed in that direction. They're fighting UFADA. So, Scott, I guess on the legal standpoint, first of all, there is not a consensus on what should happen. Fair?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, and Mike framed it very interestingly that the law has to decide if a person who is deceased has privacy. Are there any other tangents to the law or previous frameworks that can help us understand privacy after death?
Well, I think traditionally, you know, the presumption was that you did not have much privacy after death, because privacy, as Mike has implied, is a right that we enjoy while we're alive. But as records have migrated from the very limited paper records to much more intimate, comprehensive electronic records, which can continue long after we die, I think that is changing, and that conception is changing. Additionally, we've seen a lot of celebrities, depending on what state they die in, have personality rights, and their estates have pursued that. So I think that has trickled down to the individual for people to say, well, wait a minute, you know, after I die, maybe my images could be used. So that's why I think our concepts of this are changing.
When you wrote the piece you wrote the piece, by the way, about this. Where's your work published on this that sparked this whole conversation?
This is in the New York Daily Record, which is Western New York's legal newspaper of record.
Okay, because what I want to do with Scott Maloof, and again, an attorney who I always think of Scott as the local attorney who specializes in social media, but Scott helps other attorneys use and sort of sift through social media as needed. And this is a growing and changing world, so Scott's expertise is certainly helpful to us. And let's look at the legal side first. Mike Johansson's going to help us understand what we all can do while we're living, which is hopefully for a very, very long time, to think about and plan for these things. And then we'll get to your questions. If you want to join the program, if you can do it online, at Evan Dawson on Twitter, or you can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You heard the words of the father who lost his son to suicide, who was frustrated that he couldn't get access to a Facebook account. Do you think he should? And you know, how do we deal with that? So, Scott, in your piece that you wrote about this and the potential law, you asked the question, why is the act needed? And we've kind of waded through some of that. You say, if attorneys are making provisions and planning for digital assets already, why is the act needed?
Mm-hmm. And two answers to that. One is because the online service providers, Yahoo, et cetera, have their concerns about this are founded in the law called the Stored Communications Act, which is a federal law that talks about when one can access online communications, email, Facebook, that are private. And so one reason for that is no matter what you, Evan, may provide in your planning documents, they are always bound by that law and they're going to look at that law. And so, you know, as attorneys, we can only do so much and work within the law. A second reason is because even though we're discussing online documents, all of us have hardware in front of us, all of us are using hardware, and this law also helps to clarify when a fiduciary can access hardware, because that's also a growing issue. If you have to crack a computer to get someone's password to then access those online accounts or records, the people you go see may say, whoa, wait a minute, this violates potential state and federal criminal laws. I need to know that you actually have authority to give this to me for this person who's passed on.
Okay. Do you want to jump in there, Mike?
Well,
go ahead.
There's just one other thing. We're talking about access to these things in the unfortunate, you know, someone passing away. just to get access to them. But there's another big consideration here. Accounts that are left sitting around and not closed are potentially targets for people who are looking to do identity theft. So there's an actual good reason you'd want these accounts closed down after you've passed away. You don't want someone passing themselves off as your dead uncle, dead whatever.
And there's one more I would add to that, which is we've discussed death, but there's also incapacity. There's a number of situations where people are running businesses using these kinds of accounts, and they become incapacitated, say, due to a stroke. Well, you have to have, in those situations, instant access. And as you just saw in the terms that you read from Google, it can be take quite a long time. And as that time is ticking away, the business itself, which may have dependents, is dripping away.
Okay. So, unfortunately, these are not hypotheticals or things to sort of snicker at. Already I'm getting a note from Jen who says, I'm tired of seeing a friend of mine who passed away show up on Facebook. And I assume what she means is, Mike, you're nodding already. What do you think she means exactly?
Well, this actually happens to me too. My mother passed away a year ago this past summer. The year before that, we'd created a Facebook account for her so she'd have access to all the grandchildren's pictures. And she got a lot of joy out of that. Now she shows up in those little miniature pictures that says, you know, friends or
people you know, connections,
that kind of thing, and people you have in common with other people like cousins and brothers and sisters. I actually, whenever I see it, it sort of brings a smile to me. I know that's not the case for my sister. I think it bothers her a lot.
That's interesting. Do you blame Facebook? I mean, do they seem to be trying to address it? I'm trying to figure out exactly what their policy is as well, Mike, but are they handling it well?
Complicated. I mean, if one of us were to take the initiative, we could actually work with Facebook through time and very likely get it closed. But I believe it's a process. Everyone I've talked to says it is a process. It's a months-long process.
So back to where we are with the law. Scott, does the act change who owns an account? That's an interesting question because, again, you've passed away or are incapacitated. And who owns an account versus who has access? Is there an important legal distinction?
There is an important distinction. And for those folks right now trying to figure out how to bequeath their iTunes account, this law will not help you do that. Because if you look online, many proponents of this law are very excited to do that. No, the law only addresses access. It does not in any way change the relationship, the business relationship between the service provider and the individual who signed on for the service.
How the act works. How does the act work? You write, in the basic case of a person dying with a will, leaving all property to a spouse, doesn't that include digital assets?
You have to go back to the original contract. Let's say your iTunes account. An iTunes account is pretty clearly going to say, this is a service. It's a service for you provided on a monthly or yearly basis, however you paid for it. And it likely in that account terms of service says it terminates upon your death. Now, you may have some that continue on and on. You could have theoretically, I looked at eBay's terms of service. I didn't see anything explicitly talking about death. So theoretically, one might be able to run an eBay store depending on how they interpret their own agreements. So you really can't bequeath something that you only have a life interest in.
Again, if you're just joining us, we're talking about UFADA.
UFADA.
UFADA, which is the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Assets Act. New York, one of the states that has expressed at least some interest. That's right?
Correct. There are 28 states that are interested in it right now. New York is one of those, and Delaware has actually made it their law.
All right. Jenny wants to talk about, hold on a second. Sometimes I see a long email. I try to edit on the fly. And that's why it's always good to contact us on Twitter. But you can email the program as well. It's edawson@wxxi.org. Jenny just wants to know why would any parent be denied answers if they could be found through social media after losing a loved one, particularly if they lose a child? The heartbreaking story of that man and his son is a perfect example. I know that's the center of the case. But Ginny is asking, isn't it natural that parents would be given that access, et cetera? I don't know. Mike, again, that's what this is all about. But what do you think when you hear that question?
Well, if you're the social media service provider, you're between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
You've really made it pretty clear that when people share things with you, they belong to that account, and that account belongs to you. For them to start opening those accounts up to other people, might be seen by some as a violation of that trust. And in social media, I think a lot of these account platforms have enough issues with trust as it is without, you know, adding fuel to the fire.
Should there be a difference in who gets access to social media, Facebook accounts, private messages? Should there be a difference between someone who passes away naturally and someone who passes away in, and again, I don't know how you quantify this or qualify it in law, but questionable circumstances, a suicide, a different kind of a case, someone dying young. Should there be a difference?
Well, I'd actually be interested in, from Scott's perspective, on knowing why. I mean, I know that courts can order unsealing of documents and unsealing of wills and unsealing of all kinds of closed lock boxes of records. I'm sort of wondering why courts can't do that with social media.
That's a good question. You're going to throw me the hard one, huh? In this situation, and Evan, I'll get to what you said about different situations. The real law we look at here is a federal law. And normally estate proceedings are going to take place on a state level. So that's one level of complication. A judge, say, in surrogates court here in New York has to now apply a federal statute. But the federal statute, the Stored Communications Act, is very clear. The content of the account can only be provided in very narrow circumstances. There's an exception for law enforcement. It can be provided to the person who owns the account and the intended recipient. And that's it. And so that's why these cases have become very difficult, because this law is pretty far-reaching and is binding. And you can obviously understand, if you're Facebook, you don't want to get literally 500 subpoenas a day for matrimonial cases and other kinds of cases. And as to your question about, you know, different death situations, I think that's one of the things that this law is trying to address, is interposing a court using the systems we already have to say certain situations we should, as opposed to the very binary systems that these companies have. But the real challenge is cost. If we start, the more exceptions we make, the more nuances we make, the more we drive up costs, both legal costs, but also costs for these companies providing services.
And if we try to bifurcate death into natural death and death that needs more explanation, you know, that it's a strange thing to do. Pre-social media, you know, that's a question that never would have come up. I mean, Facebook didn't exist 10 years ago, I don't think. So Scott, you're an attorney. If the law tries to codify two levels of death, that would seem to be very difficult, easy to dispute, or easy just for a company to say one thing or the other. Nobody ever gets access, or sure, if anybody wants it can have access to an account.
Right. Easy to dispute and very hard to implement, too.
Yeah.
So it's and also, Evan, whenever you're drafting a law, whenever you're drafting any kind of planning documents or a contract, you're really trying to look forward 5 or 10 years into the future. For example, in wills, you know, you may have a person draft something and literally not come back for years and years and have huge life changes. So that's why it's so difficult to do these things, and an act like UFADA tries to step in to provide a lot of leeway and leverage for courts and individuals to do something and encompass a lot of circumstances.
Deb writes, I lost a family member to suicide. No one should ever try to limit access to information that would help people understand. Again, I understand the sentiment. I really do. You know, Mike, you're nodding just because I'm sure you feel the same way. I'm not saying you agree with her. I'm saying it's easy to understand that emotion.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. And I think in the same way that you plan a will, I think increasingly people are going to figure out they need to plan for their digital assets. And Scott and I were talking earlier about, I went looking for this, and there's a list out there of dozens and dozens, close to 100 companies that are willing to help you do that.
Willing to help you do what? Explain a little bit.
Well, everything from electronic lock boxes that can only be activated by trustees of your will to get access to all your passwords and all your accounts, to people who will go out and actually search the web for all mentions, find those accounts, and do the footwork for gaining access to the accounts for you. And, you know, there's all these companies willing to do it, and there's even a big movement afoot now to get couples, for example, to swap a list of passwords. I'll give you my list of passwords, you give me mine, one of us passes away, the other person has access.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, most of the time, couples may assume that they have all the passwords, And I'm not here to give any marital advice, so neither is Scott or Mike, because I understand it's a separate question on whether some couples choose to share passwords for email and accounts, et cetera, and that's not for me to judge. But Mike, in the case that we're talking about here, in the case of losing someone, is it wise to make that plan and to share those
In my opinion, it would be.
Yeah.
And there's several ways you can do this. For example, you might do something like have a safety deposit box at a bank that has all of your important stuff in it, including your passwords to all your accounts.
But aren't we supposed to change our passwords like every other day?
That's where I was going with this. You're one step ahead of me as always, Evan.
Because I don't think I had not changed one of my email accounts, the password, in about a decade. And then all of a sudden, in January, I'd started here at WXXI, and 2 days after I started, everybody I knew was getting a letter saying that I would soon be looking for help because I was stranded in the Philippines, and I needed lots of money and probably a plane ride, and could anybody do it? Well, they heard me on WXXI, and they were wondering why I was broadcasting from the Philippines. Mm. And I lost a remarkable amount, and I learned that lesson. So I have been changing, as Mike has been telling me for years, I've been changing passwords, and I guess that's just something you have to stay on top of.
So you didn't get that money I sent you.
I did not get the money that you sent. But you're saying actually take the passwords and physically store it.
Well, that would be one way to do it. And then to make that manageable, set yourself a reminder that every 3 months all your passwords need to be changed, and then you take that list and go to visit the bank and you put it, you know, do it all at once, so you keep it simple.
Does anybody do that? Do you do that?
Actually, I do. I do, and that's come because I had your exact experience about 2.5 years ago. My Gmail account was hacked.
It's awful.
And it was only through the good services of a friend who works at Google that I got mine back very quickly, within a little over 2 weeks. It's pretty unusual. But yeah, I mean, really, that's come to that, unfortunately.
But let me add to that. That I agree that those are good ideas. I have hard copies of my passwords as well. But that can be incredibly difficult to do for two reasons. One, if you have two-factor authentication on any service or device, it will say, wow, this looks like a very different place you're logging in from. We've sent you a text message. And maybe you don't have that phone because it's, you know, back at the decedent's home. The second challenge is a lot of work-provided devices, or the opposite, where work content is on your own device, and your workplace may say you cannot share your PIN to your phone with your spouse. And so that, I agree, those are great suggestions, but there are going to be situations where it just would not work.
Like always, shades of gray.
Shades of gray.
Dan writes, and again, if you're just joining us, we told the story of the Rash family in Virginia in early 2011. Ricky Rash lost his son, a 15-year-old, to suicide, and he was surprised when he was told he could not get access to his son's Facebook account. And he was, I think, frustrated by that and confused as to why he would not. Dan writes, and can't the family sue Facebook for access?
Well, you can sue.
I guess you can sue anybody. You can try to sue anybody for anything. But realistically, Scott, and if you're just joining us, Scott Maloof is an attorney. Is that a course of is that recourse that is realistic?
It's a very challenging way to do this. For example, let's take a minor. You know, we've been talking about minors. Normally, minors do not have the ability to sign a contract. You know, and there are certain kinds of contracts, such as real estate, that are void. Minors cannot make those kinds of contracts generally. But there are other contracts that are called voidable, meaning the minor signs it, and then the minor can terminate the contract. This has come up in litigation against Facebook. For example, there's been several cases of using the images, as you talked about seeing the image, Mike. And so there have been several cases against Facebook of minors saying, you're using my image to promote services, et cetera, et cetera. I am suing Facebook directly. And the issue that came up was, you're a minor. You've signed this contract with Facebook. Are you bound by the terms? And there have been three cases on this. And in all three cases, even though these people were under 18, the courts held that the contracts were binding on them because the minors did not void them, did not go back to Facebook when they discovered the problems and terminate the contract. So that's the situation we're in, that yes, you can sue, and to get to your answer, once you're in that contract with Facebook, Facebook's got a forum selection clause that says you have to sue us in San Mateo County, California, and so now you're bringing suit in a very expensive place with judges and attorneys who are a little bit hopefully more familiar, but you're bringing suit against the local player, whereas obviously you'd rather sue in a jurisdiction that maybe has more favorable law or closer to your home.
Yeah, I mean, boy, I'm assuming Facebook is well-heeled with attorneys.
You know, I don't know the size of their actual internal Facebook legal department. I suspect it's not humongous, but yeah, I'm sure they can get representation if they need it.
Before we get to the phones, and I see the phones ringing, Mike, we've talked about privacy as an issue and the importance of social media companies protecting your privacy, and you've been a little tough on Facebook in the past. Yahoo seems to be the company that's leading the way against this proposed legislation. What do you make of their claims about privacy?
I actually think that, again, as is a lot of the instances where this is coming up, it has to do with money. If they agree to this, what are they giving up in terms of exclusive access to data that they can sell to advertisers, information that they control? Are they giving up some of that control? And I guess control is really what it's all about for Yahoo and other companies like it.
So you see somewhat nefarious purposes?
Well, I don't know nefarious. They're in business. I mean, they've got to pay their bills. Everyone has to pay bills.
But they're saying it's sort of this protect the customer at all costs. It's about privacy, and you're saying it might also be a business decision.
Yeah. I would say that would be equally valid from their point of view.
Paul in Webster. Go ahead, Paul. Thanks for calling Connections.
Hey, thanks. Interesting discussion. I was wondering, I have a will. If I were to add an amendment or codicil, whatever the legal term is, to the will, authorizing the executor of my estate to access my different online accounts, would that be a way to handle this?
Let me start with the attorney, Scott.
You know, some practitioners have talked about putting information in your will and looking at that. I think you still run into the challenge that the Stored Communications Act is going to be something that controls your relationship regardless of what you've put in your will. And then secondly, it can be very challenging to dictate what you want to do in a will. As I said before, we make account selections, we make wills, and then we put them away for years and years. You may have major life changes. You know, if you have a young child at home who you didn't have when you made that will, you may not want them to see a lot of those things, and yet you didn't make any directive in your will. So it's an option, but it can create as much confusion as it answers.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. I think it's a very good question. Mike, aren't you glad I kicked it to the attorney?
Yeah. Yeah. Although, interesting, I have just a slight insight on this. My dad worked in the legal business for decades, and one of the things he always used to say is don't put anything in your will that's going to put an undue burden on the people trying to execute it. And I would say that in that case, you might be putting an undue burden on the executors of the will to say, go in to get access to all these accounts. And if they can't, if Facebook and whatever say no, what's the executor supposed to do?
Right. And then you have the issue of what state. You know, we've got a lot of people in New York who are living in Florida. You know, if you die in Florida, yet you have assets in a third state, now you're looking at three different states' laws to apply. And again, it could add a lot of cost and complication to something that we'd hoped would be simpler.
We're going to take a short break, come back, and if you're just joining us, we have Scott Maloof, who is an attorney who really assists other attorneys using social media, text, and web-based evidence. You can find Scott at scottmaloof.com. Mike Johansson lectures on social media and digital communications at the New School of Communication at RIT and offers social media solutions through his endeavor called Fixitology. If you've missed the early part of the conversation, we're going to come back and reset where things stand with the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Assets Act. And that, if that doesn't sound sexy enough, we joke, but it's known as UFADA. It's important. New York is one of the states looking at this, and we'll update you on where things stand with this when we come back right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we talk to the people behind Conscious Capitalism. It's a movement to promote ethics in business and create more sustainable ethical businesses nationwide. So what makes for an ethical business? What are the standards that support the conscious capitalism movement? We'll find out on Wednesday on Connections with Evan Dawson.
After he was elected governor of Kansas in 2010, Sam Brownback carried out the Republican dream. He cut taxes dramatically and promised good times ahead.
So you really get your acceleration. This is like shooting adrenaline into the heart of growing the economy.
But the good times did not come, and now Brownback's fighting for his political life. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections here on member-supported public radio. It's Tuesday afternoon, and we're looking at the question of who owns our digital assets, especially in the event of our incapacitation or our passing. And it's a question that's come up in legal cases. It's a question that has unfortunately come up in tragic cases of suicide. And you know, Mike, without getting specific, Mike Johansson and I were talking about the fact that it doesn't have to be a suicide. People can die it has happened in unfortunate circumstances where there may be text messages involved, social media messages that might shed light, and there might be questions on who gets access to those, right? I mean, I've been referring to this Virginia case and many others, suicide cases where people want to know, are there any clues on Facebook or social media? Unfortunately, doesn't have to be suicide, right, Mike?
No, I mean, it can be all kinds of things. You know, people are not always aware of relationships people have on social media with other people. And, you know, you might be surprised to find that, you know, someone was connected to some people you didn't know at all, and those people might have some light to shed on why someone might have committed suicide, for example.
Yeah. So at the heart of all of this is the question of what the law says or what it should say. And so we're asking Scott Maloof to reset for us UFATA, the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Assets Act, that's going on. Where do things stand? Give us a quick kind of a reset on what it would do and where things are.
UFATA is a law proposed by the Uniform Law Commission, and what that means, it's a model act, as they say, which every state could implement on its own. The goal is to have the same law in all the states so that things work the same way everywhere you are. Right now, the law has been enacted in Delaware, and there are 28 other states who have expressed some sort of interest in it. And the goal of the law is to provide fiduciaries, such as the executor of your will, someone who's dealing with a power of attorney, access to your online accounts.
So Delaware's passed it.
Yep.
They're it so far. But if New York passes it, my understanding based on the description is that I'm trying to make sure I understand. You talk about fiduciary, the executor of an estate, or
a power of attorney. There are four that the act thinks about.
Okay.
One is the executor of a will.
Yep.
One is the trustee of a trust. Another is the attorney who is operating under a power of attorney, mm-hmm. an attorney not being one with a law degree, but the person who has the power of attorney. And finally, a conservator, that being someone who we traditionally think of as appointed by a court when you're incapacitated, maybe due to a health reason or some other reason.
Most of the time, I would think that when we pass away, and again, we all hope that's a long time in the future, our email and social media accounts won't be of all that much interest, I wouldn't think, but there are times where they might be. And Scott, is this, if every state had this law, I guess at least number one, it would clarify and it would remove some confusion, yes?
Yes. I mean, right now, as we talked about, there are 8 or 9 states that have some kind of law addressing these. Virginia, in the wake of Ricky Rash's son's unfortunate passing, passed a law about accessing the accounts of minors. But other states do not have that. So having one law that's the same everywhere makes it a lot simpler.
Okay. Do attorneys like yourself, are you rooting for uniformity?
Well, I guess it goes back to that old law school question, who's my client? But uniformity is always better in the sense of it's easy and it gives me a lot of case law. For example, if all 50 states have this, you know, maybe a court in Massachusetts has addressed the issue that rises up here in New York. And it makes it easier to write that contract that covers all 50 states. That said, you know, the interests of the companies, as Mike pointed to, there's a lot of interests who have large financial bets made, and they may not be rooting for this because right now their default position is often, let's just delete the account when the user passes. And that's much simpler than the UFATA situations.
When they delete it, do they expose themselves to potential issues? Any kind of blowback for deletion of an account, Scott?
Well, it depends. I mean, it depends on the situation. The number one issue would be who owns this account? You know, have they even genuinely passed away? You want to make sure that if you're deleting it, it was at the request of the right user.
Yeah.
There's also situations where there is pending litigation and they've been asked to store it. And so there's a case out of Massachusetts where that had happened, and they were required, not by this law, but by others, to keep it because they know it's part of pending litigation. So any action you take can expose you to concerns. And again, that's why something like UFATA is good, because it gives you that 50-state case law. It gives you some clarity of the issues.
Before I get to Mike Johansson for some other possible solutions or ideas on fixes, the man is behind Fixitology. He's always got a fix for us. Scott, as an attorney who helps specialize in social media, who helps other attorneys look at social media in different ways, these are issues that did not exist in the world before. Are we going to see more people with your background to help us out? I mean, is this happening because the world has changed so much and we never thought about losing a child and having to find a Facebook page to kind of mine?
Yeah, as we migrate what we do. Facebook, as you said, didn't exist 10 years ago. I believe that's the number. We're going to have to see more people consider these things in their trust and estates planning, in their financial plans. And as new services come online, Apple's just introduced their new payment plan and their payment system. And so if you take, okay, we're talking about Facebook photos, they're very sentimental. What happens when you have somebody who runs a business or someone who has dedicated a lot of time to using that kind of online payment system and they pass away? How are you going to interact as the spouse, as the executor of a will, with that company? The templates we set now for social media will affect those services that come up, 3, 5, 10 years from now.
And then 3, 5, 10 years from now, social media will be so different that we'll have to start over, which is what Mike is often telling us. But Mike, what solutions are there that you want people to think about?
Well, there's a lot of solutions out there, but just very quickly before we get to that, the one thing I would say is think about your motives for wanting to get into these accounts. We've talked about getting the information out of them, but on Facebook, for example, you have two options. One is you can shut the account down, or you can turn it into what they call a memorial. In other words, people can't post to it anymore, but you can allow certain people to comment there if they want to. You're memorializing the person, in other words. So that's just something to think about. But there's a whole bunch of services out there. I went looking for a list. There's a website called The Digital Beyond that maintains a list of online services designed to help you plan for your digital death, afterlife, or to memorialize loved ones. And it starts with this quirky service where you sign up, you have an email that you leave with them, and then they email you every few weeks. And if you don't respond, the email goes out to inform all your friends that you no longer exist.
That's a little strange. And does that cost money?
Oh, yeah.
It costs money, and they badger you every few weeks, and if you don't...
No, they don't badger you. No, every few weeks they send an email just to confirm that you're still alive.
That's badgering, but go ahead.
But here's why I wouldn't recommend this service. You miss that one email in your pile of email, and all of a sudden all your friends are getting an email saying you're no longer with us, and here's the farewell email. So that's probably something not to...
Boy. Yeah. Which one's that, Colin?
Actually, there's one I didn't make a note of because I really can't recommend that as a service.
Okay. I was going to say, that's a good idea.
But there are plenty of other services that allow you to do things. A thing called Password Box allows you to use encrypted space to store passwords, other account information, and then you designate recipients. And you can set up different triggers for that access. One can be a death notice. One can be your account executor contacting. The only access the executor has is to Password Box. So that's one thing. There's a few others. Afternote, again, it sort of allows you to plan everything that you want to do with your social media accounts. It allows you essentially to write a social media will. I want these accounts just to go away. I would like these images to be saved and sent to my daughter, my son, whatever. Secure Safe is another pretty big popular one. There's one called Notify Me, which is KNOTIFY.me. It's a free application that basically sort of says, what happens to all my online accounts if I get amnesia, Alzheimer's, or if I leave this world? And you set up future notifications to be sent to your family and beloved ones in the these different circumstances. So it's all kind of interesting stuff. And the one I like the best, of course, and maybe Scott likes this too, is a company called WebCease, W-E-B-C-E-A-S-E. Basically, if you haven't done any of this planning, WebCease has a bunch of digital detectives that go out and find everything for you and then have an executive trustee decide what to do with them.
Are you comfortable with that, Scott?
Well, I agree. That's one approach you can take. As I understand their service, they search via email. So you're always at risk of, you know, if you signed up, Evan, for that service with an email you no longer use, maybe your executors missed that. So that's a challenge. But it's at least a place to start.
I want to read a comment from Alex. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to rely on Mike Johansson to help me understand it because I've never used Snapchat. But here's Alex. I tell friends that Snapchat doesn't really delete. I can see Snapchat factoring in car crashes or other events if Snapchat will release the video. That's a kind of a somewhat disturbing image, but okay, let's talk about that. Mike, what is Snapchat?
So Snapchat's the service that sends a photograph, an image to someone, and you predetermine how many seconds it'll be displayed to the recipient. So you say 6 seconds, I send you a snap. You look at it, you read the caption. After 6 seconds, it goes away, allegedly. However, of course, because it's digital, because it had to pass through servers, it's highly likely it's stored somewhere.
Okay, it's highly likely it's stored somewhere. It's supposed to delete. So Alex is saying if Snapchat will release it, but why would Snapchat release video in those kind of circumstances?
Well, I think we're going back to the thing of law enforcement being able to subpoena, search for, if they know it exists. I'm not sure how they would know it exists if it's only there for such a brief period of time and only between two individuals.
Yeah,
I think this goes to two issues. One, when we talk law enforcement, there are several portions of the Stored Communications Act that do make provision for law enforcement to get this. And looking at the Snapchat example, one thing, and Mike, I want to hear your input on this, would be third-party applications that keep Snapchat, which we've seen, as well as people taking screenshots of snaps that they have. So that could be where the data comes from, not Snapchat itself, but the data coming from a third party who's forced to turn it over. And the other issue, of course, is just the metadata. The fact that you did send a snap at a certain time could be relevant to the car accident. There's a New Jersey case where the plaintiff brought a claim against not the driver, but the person who knew the driver was driving and was sending text messages continuously during the driver's route, during the trip. And so the plaintiff sought to make the person sending the text messages liable. And the mere fact that the messages were sent, that was what was important. The texts and what the content was, not as important.
Okay. But that's a whole other legal question, which is a very interesting one. If you're driving, and I know you're driving, and I am texting you, that was the claim, right? That I would be liable because I'm texting you knowing that you're operating a vehicle.
Right.
And therefore, I could be somewhat culpable.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you prove that a person, I guess, can you prove that someone knew that someone was driving? And you know, where do those kind of cases shake out?
In that particular case, it was, the two parties were boyfriend and girlfriend. So you already had this very tight relationship. And they had, before the trip started, they had been exchanging text messages, I think rather heatedly. And so it was a very unique set of circumstances that the messages continued as the driving was going on. And I think the driver had said, I am busy driving. And the real crux was, did the individual who was sending it, the person who was not driving, did she know he was likely to respond? And the court said no liability on that fact pattern. But you can see, and as the services develop, you know, say a Facebook slingshot, which demands you do something before you can see the picture, that may create a different liability profile.
See, I don't even know what a Facebook slingshot is. but just back there, Scott, is it correct that we still have not seen a case where someone was deemed liable for texting someone knowing they were driving?
To my knowledge, we haven't seen that case yet.
I have a hard time with that just because I don't think anybody should be texting someone if they know they're driving. But we've got to get a culture. We've got to create a culture where you don't have the phone on your lap or in your hand. That even a phone in the back seat or out of reach, or that you're just have enough willpower to ignore it. And I would have a hard time thinking a judge or a jury would say, well, that person was unable to ignore that text when it was coming in. Ultimately, isn't it the responsibility of the driver not to look?
I think that's going to be a big hurdle to overcome. Anybody who is sitting on a jury is going to say, you know, turn off your phone, put it in the glove compartment. So that would be a very tough case.
If I ever get called for jury duty on this issue, I'm just going to produce this file and they'll say, you're dismissed, Mr. Dawson. We understand where you stand on this. But I just, you know, I would have a hard time with that. Mike?
Yeah, well, just let me give a quick shout out. The Ad Council of Rochester actually currently has a public service campaign on this very topic called You Are That Distracting. And one of the main images, for example, has a driver at the wheel with someone dangling a dress on a hanger right in front of them, you know, saying, obviously the texting back and forth, someone's in the store, knows the other person's driving, but they're busy texting pictures of the dress they're looking
sure.
at. And that's, I believe, comes out of cases just like that. Mm-hmm. You know, people who deliberately call or text someone they know who's driving probably should be somewhat liable for distracting that driver.
But I think with the Ad Council, they're not appealing to a legal basis. They're appealing to our moral basis to say, let that person alone, that it can wait, as opposed to you could go to jail for this.
Right.
Right? That's how you take it too, Scott?
I think so.
Okay. Well, I think we all agree. If you know someone is driving, stop texting them.
But back to social media.
but texting is sort of in this category, though, or maybe it isn't. Scott is illegally is texting outside the world of social media in terms of access to it. Who would be allowed access to it in terms of, let's say, unfortunately, in the case of a suicide, would someone be allowed to access text messages but not a Facebook account?
You know, Evan, and Mike has said this, it's all nuance, and I think it's really going to depend on what they were doing, when, and what services they were using. If you're using a Google Hangouts, say, which takes a text message maybe from a traditional provider like a Verizon and moves it over to Google services, I think we could see that under case law as social media versus the straight text message, or if you're getting email notifications of text messages. So it becomes a very fact-dependent analysis.
Okay. Mike, do you view texting outside the realm of social media in that?
Yes, but then, of course, there are texting apps like WhatsApp and so forth that are coming in that really are social in nature. They act just like text messaging, but they're happening through an app.
What is WhatsApp?
WhatsApp, the biggest social media network in Russia, for example, just starting to take off here. It's pretty fast going. It's like texting, but you're not using your data on your phone, so you're not being charged enormous amounts of money like you would be if you're tearing through your data plan. So it's quite popular with people who text a lot.
It's essentially texting in the same way that the old school instant messenger was like texting, but that was through, I guess, through an app, right? We call it an app program.
But it was pretty much web-based too,
okay.
I believe.
Okay, same kind of a thing there. Chris wants to know if there would be a difference between what parents would be allowed to access versus what a government subpoena would. If there's a potential criminal case, I guess I'm sure the answer is yes. But Scott, when it comes to a potential criminal or questions of criminality?
Yeah, criminal cases, you're looking at a very different set of rules because there is an understanding in the law that you may need to perform an investigation versus parents who are not going to be criminal investigators, who are going to be more relying on civil access and contracts. So yeah, investigators, criminal, much higher likelihood of access to this material. Parents and others, much lower likelihood.
But I go back to Ricky Rash, where we started the conversation, the man who's, and again, Scott, you said that it was their family's case that helped change Virginia law?
That's correct. Ricky is an advocate for this stuff, and he actually was just, I talked to Ricky yesterday, and he was down advocating for UFATA in the Virginia legislature.
Okay. And you know, he loses a 15-year-old son to suicide, and I can see the Ricky Rashes of the world saying, I can't, as the parent, see their Facebook messages, but the government can if they choose it, and that's got to drive people nuts, too. But, again, that's where Scott, the lawyer, is going to tell us, you know, that's where the legal distinctions come in. I mean, there's a difference between an emotional parent and an investigating government.
Right. And understandably so in the law because, you know, one is serving the entire society with a criminal investigation and another is trying to look at the interests of a parent in relation to a child. You may have a child whose parent is estranged And so Facebook could easily interpose and say, you know, this person, this child has passed away, but, you know, we've been received information that you haven't had any role in their life.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thanks, gentlemen, for getting us up to speed. Let's wrap the conversation with this. Scott, as we look at UFADA and other issues surrounding this, what's the takeaway for you and for us understanding on the legal side?
I think the takeaway is just what Mike said, which is, one, be prepared, take measures on your own. Don't wait for these particular laws to be enacted. And I just want to go back to something Ricky said very quickly, which was, you know, he's a Virginian and a sense of history is baked into their very DNA. And he said, you know, when somebody passes away, especially someone younger, there's a loss to our society because when their records are deleted, their descendants and their family don't know as much about who they are. And so I think that's what you should keep in mind. How do you want to share that legacy? You know, and plan accordingly going forward.
Yeah, Mike?
Yeah, and I obviously agree with all that, and the planning is very important. And one thing, another thing that I kind of counsel people on is don't lose track of all your social online presences. It can be very easy just to add another one. Just maintain a list somewhere of your account names. Keep the passwords separate by all means. In fact, you should keep the passwords separate. But it can be so easy to be on, suddenly be on 15 to 20 different social networks. You're only using three or four of them. If you're not using them, I mean, I did this exercise the end of last summer. I just went through and killed off four that I hadn't used in over a year.
What was an example?
One called Plurk, P-L-U-R-K.
I mean, there's so many out there,
yeah.
I guess.
And it was kind of a popular social network for a while, and there were a lot of people in New Zealand, my home country, on it. So I thought, well, I'll sign up, and maybe some friends of mine will be on it. And I just didn't use it, so delete it.
And here I thought you were Australian.
cut to the bone.
I never actually thought you were Australian, but I do know how to cut you. Mike Johansson lectures on social media and digital communications at RIT's New School of Communication, and you can find Mike online. Where, Mike?
On Twitter at MikeJNY, or email me at MikeJ@fixitology.com.
All right. Scott Maloof is an attorney who helps other attorneys use social media, text, and web-based evidence, and that world is growing, as we're seeing. ScottMaloof.com and on Twitter at Scott Maloof. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
And thanks for all the interesting questions that have come in online and via phone these 2 hours today. Roger, thanks for your work behind the glass, our engineer. I'm Evan Dawson, and you're listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.